This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, I'm Nicholas Gordon, host of the Asian Review of Books podcast, done in collaboration with the New Books Network. In this podcast, we interview fiction and nonfiction authors working in, around, and about the Asia-Pacific region. On September 2, 1945, Japan surrendered to the United States, ending the Second World War. Yet the Japanese invasion upended the old geopolitical structures of European empires, leaving old imperial powers on the decline and new groups calling for independence on the rise. That unsteady situation sparked a decade of conflict in Indonesia, in Vietnam, in China, and in Korea, as esteemed military historian Professor Ronald Spector writes about in his latest book, A Continent Erupts, Decolonization, Civil War, and Massacre in Postwar Asia, published by W.W. Norton. Ronald Spector, Professor Emeritus of History and International Relations at George Washington University, is the author of seven books, including Eagle Against the Sun, The American War with Japan, and In the Ruins of Empire, The Japanese Surrender, and the Battle for Postwar Asia. Today, Ronald and I talk about the decade of conflict following the Second World War and whether those conflicts were inevitable in the post-colonial Cold War world. So, Ronald, thank you so much for coming on the show to talk about A Continent Erupts. You know, perhaps it's easiest to kind of start at the beginning. The period you cover begins with the end of the Second World War in Asia, after the Japanese have first radically changed the order of things in Asia and then were defeated by the Americans. What was the state of Asia, of kind of the Asian political order immediately after the Second World War? Why was it so? What made it so unstable?
The old order in Asia, which basically had been characterized by almost complete colonization of everything east of Suez, had been completely upset by the sudden Japanese conquest of all of these countries, with the exception of India, all of these countries which had been either colonies of Europe or strongly under European domination, such as China. All of that disappeared very suddenly in 1941 and early 42, when the Japanese just very rapidly rolled over Southeast Asia, and they had already conquered a good deal of China. So that when the war ended, there was really no settled system in Asia. The people living in various parts of Asia were not very enthusiastic about returning to the old order. The Europeans Most of them would have liked to reinstate the old colonial system, but they were not in a situation where they could do so. They were economically devastated by the effects of World War II. So it was a completely different world from what it had been in 1941.
You know, it's interesting you bring up the Europeans, because that's a good segue to my next question. You know, in reading the book, especially the bits on the conflict in Indonesia and the conflict in Vietnam, it vaguely always seems like the Europeans, whether it's the Dutch or the French, or even other European powers, I don't know the best word to use, whether it's they seem really bullheaded about their colonies, they seem really boneheaded about their colonies. It seems like there are plenty of they never seem quite able to either offer enough concessions or some or someone very aggressive comes in charge and derails all these negotiations. I guess, why were the Europeans so unwilling to compromise or compromise enough when it came to their colonies?
Well, I think the main problem that they had, although they certainly weren't aware of it, is that they hadn't really made any preparations or instituted any significant changes during the 1920s and 30s when they could have. They might have followed the pattern of the British in India, who allowed a significant amount of political activity by the Indians themselves, and were gradually implementing various means of local self-government in India. The Dutch and the French could have followed the same pattern, but they didn't. And so it was very difficult for them, even if they were so inclined to suddenly create a self-governing entity to replace their colonies, one that would have been very friendly to them and would have kept up all the old existing economic relationships. Of course, they weren't inclined to do that anyway. They simply needed to get back into their old colonies because they were in dire economic straits themselves. So they wanted to get back to the old order as quickly as possible.
So the book covers, I believe, four conflicts. You can forgive me if I've missed one, but it covers conflicts like Indonesia and Vietnam, which are kind of post-colonial independence conflicts. There's the Chinese Civil War, which is, as its name implies, kind of a civil war between the nationalists and the Communist Party. There's the Korean War, which is kind of a de facto international conflict. But kind of what kind of connects all of these? Are these different conflicts kind of connected by the same theme is the wrong word, but kind of connected by the same pressures, inspired by the same, I guess, structural problems? What kind of connects all of these well, Asian conflicts?
What I argue in the book is they're not simply anti-colonial wars or wars for independence. These are all they don't necessarily take the same shape, but they are all civil wars in nature. They either begin as civil wars, or they develop into civil wars, or they are both international and civil wars at the same time. So in all of these conflicts, you have the native population, the local population, is usually split between at least two sides, and at the same time, the two sides in a lot of cases have to confront the former colonial powers, and They also have to confront the developing U.S.-Soviet tensions that are growing out of developments in Europe and the Middle East. And in many cases, the various sides in the Civil War want to take advantage of these U.S.-Soviet rivalries to get one of the great powers on their side to help them win their particular local struggle for control of their newly independent or what they hope will soon be independent countries.
So I want to ask about the Chinese Civil War, specifically kind of the relationship between the whether real or perceived, the kind of the U.S. relationship with the Chinese Communist Party. You know, I remember when I was studying this in high school a while ago, you know, everyone was always surprised by, I believe it was the Dixie mission, you know, the mission to Yan'an in the Second World War, which, you know, led to some pretty glowing glowing descriptions of the CCP at the time. I know during the Civil War and immediately afterwards, there's a lot of accusations that it was people like them, these kind of CCP sympathizers in the State Department that stopped America from really supporting the nationalists in the Chinese Civil War. And then everyone feels like forgot about that narrative, only to be kind of revived in later historical discussions of the Civil War. But I guess kind of what's your, you know, given your research and your understanding of the history, kind of what's your view of, I guess, of the CCP and whether the U.S. should have, could have more forcefully, well, either more forcefully pushed for a negotiated solution or actually have helped the nationalists defeat the CCP? Kind of what's your view of the of that conflict?
Well, at the end of the Second World War in China, very few Chinese wanted to have another war right after that. And certainly the Americans never expected that there would be another full-scale war within a year or two. But I think that the real explanation is that the leaders of the two sides, Chiang Kai-shek and Mao Zedong, were just determined to duke it out. They were determined to have a showdown for control of China. They didn't see, from their point of view, any alternative, even though very few other people wanted to see a war. I think they did, and that's really the explanation for how you could possibly have had another full-scale war break out in China just a year or so after the Japanese surrender. The U.S., of course, tried to prevent something like this happening. They sent President Truman sent the Marshall Mission to China, but that was unsuccessful because Chiang Kai-shek felt that he could, this was his great opportunity to destroy the Chinese communists, and he wasn't going to let anybody get in the way of that. And on their part, the Chinese communists felt they couldn't possibly trust Chiang Kai-shek, and besides that, they weren't going to give up the gains that they had made during the Second World War. So that the Chinese Civil War, I think you can say, really started at the top. A lot of wars start with not very significant incidents, and then they rapidly escalate into something. But in the case of the Chinese Civil War, I think it's really the two top leaders and their advisors and followers who make this decision that they're going to fight it out.
So I want to pivot now to the two. I'm going to use the word independence conflicts, even though I think, as you note, they're all kind of, they're not purely civil wars. They're part of this larger historical conversation. But anyway, but the wars in Vietnam and in Indonesia, and you know, in both of those cases, but I think especially in Vietnam, you have a local nationalist independence movement ultimately defeating kind of a more advanced country, whether it's the Dutch or the French, ostensibly backed by backed by Europe, backed by the US. But they're both defeated. How were these groups able to defeat their eventually former colonial masters?
One thing that they did is they managed to recruit powerful friends. Once the communists won the civil war in China, then they were willing to help out the Viet Minh in Vietnam. At the same time, the French, who were expected to form a key part of the new NATO alliance, succeeded after a couple of years of trying, succeeded in persuading the Americans to help them out in Indochina. And so the reason that the war took the form that it did after 1950 was that both sides are receiving modern weapons and training, which enables them to go on and fight the war at an even more deadly level than they had in the first 3 years of the conflict.
So I want to ask now about Korea. I know the book covers the whole Korean War, but one interesting historical event that I had not read before, and you kind of tie into this whole conflict, I think you call it the First Korean War at times, is the is what happens in Jeju when the South Korean government sends troops to kind of quell an quell a communist uprising on the island. I wonder if you might talk about what happens on Jeju and why you have characterized that in your book sometimes as the kind of First Korean War.
The conflict on Jeju is I didn't mean to imply that it was the whole of the First Korean War. The First Korean War takes place between about 1946 and 1950, and it's waged in South Korea between the South Korean Labor Party, which is basically a branch of the Communist Party, and their sympathizers. They also had help from various other left-leaning parties. And then Syngman Rhee and his political allies. And Rhee was not terrifically popular in the South, but he did have the support of many people from North Korea, who including landowners and businessmen and so on, who had felt that they had to flee when Kim Il-sung's regime takes over. And so all of these hundreds of thousands of people, sometimes you might say millions of people, sort of come, and they're among his most loyal supporters, along with upper class landowners and businessmen in the South, and a lot of Christians and Christian institutions in the South. so that there's kind of constant uprisings and guerrilla warfare all through South Korea between about 1940, the end of late 46 and late 49. And this warfare claims thousands of lives. And in the Jeju is one of the most extreme cases where a good percentage of the civilian population died in the uprising on Jeju, which I think, as I remember, takes place in mostly in 48, 49.
You know, throughout this whole period, the U.S. seems to play kind of an unsure and uncertain role in a lot of these conflicts. If it's not, I mean, at times it becomes an active participant, as it does in Korea. But, you know, if you're kind of reading through your book and kind of the discussions, at least on the U.S. side, they're obviously very scared, worried about communism. They want to support their European allies, but they're also very uncomfortable with outright imperialism. I'm sure people will debate whether what they're doing still counts as imperialism, but they're certainly uncomfortable with the idea of outright imperialism. You know, in reading how did U.S. officials feel about what was happening in Asia, the negotiations to kind of have colonies become independent to end these conflicts? How did the U.S. officials kind of feel about them, and how do they play a role in them?
Well, the U.S. had a long tradition of anti-colonialism, at least rhetorically. Most Americans in 1945 would say that they were opposed to colonialism. On the other hand, two important U.S. allies in Europe, the Netherlands and the French, were engaged in these two of these conflicts. In the case of the French, who were a much larger, more important country, were supposed to be really the keystone of NATO, they were afraid that the French would become so embroiled in their colonial war in Indochina that they wouldn't be able to devote sufficient resources to the defense of Europe. In the case of the Netherlands, the U.S. Initially wasn't very interested until the Cold War started to develop and started to worry a lot of people in Washington. After various crises, the Berlin blockade, the Czech coup, and so on in Europe, then American leaders anyway, became very worried that maybe the communists are going to try to take over in Asia as well. And the Dutch, Republic of Indonesia, the anti-colonialists, had a really lucky break. And that is that right about this time, there was a communist uprising in Indonesia, the Madian Rebellion, or at least it looked like communist uprisings. Most of the leaders were self-proclaimed communists. And Sukarno and the leaders of the Republic successfully put down the rebellion. And that convinced the Americans that they were true blue anti-communists and that they were deserving of American support. And from that point on, they didn't rush into The Hague and say, all right, you've got to pull out of the Netherlands Indies right now. But they from that point on, the U.S. put tremendous pressure on the Dutch to come to some kind of settlement in the Indies that would recognize, give them some type of independence. And the U.S. was able to exert an awful lot of pressure on the Dutch in order to achieve this. And the Dutch just kept doing the wrong thing in terms of PR. The Dutch decided instead of trying to persuade the U.S. that they were trying to come to a reasonable settlement, instead of that, they launched another full-scale offensive against the Indonesian Republic, and that convinced the U.S. that the Dutch just had to agree to immediate independence for most of Indonesia.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
You know, it's interesting. Sometimes you read history books, and you see all the paths that history might have taken. But interestingly, upon reading your book, I kind of came to the opposite conclusion, which was, oh no, all of this seemed inevitable, given the positions of the various players involved. But I thought I might kind of pose that question to you, whether you see all of these conflicts in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War as inevitable. You know, if the Europeans were less boneheaded about colonialism, if some of these movements like the Communist Party or the Viet Minh were, I don't know, more open to compromise, if the U.S. was more willing to work with some of these groups or pay more attention to some of these conflicts. I guess, you know, from your view of the history, do you, what were these conflicts inevitable? Was the result inevitable, or were there other possible paths that these negotiations, these conflicts may have taken?
Yes, well, I think that, as you suggested, early in these conflicts, there were lots of opportunities for compromise. Maybe not in Korea. I think that once you had Syngman Rhee and Kim Il-sung more or less firmly in control, that was it. But even there, even in Korea, there were political leaders, at least in the South, who were not aligned with Rhee, who were still hoping for some kind of agreement with the North. In some of these other countries, though, I think if the two sides had not been as stubborn as they were, certainly in the case of Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh made great efforts during 1945 and 46 to come to some kind of agreement with the French, but the French didn't really think that they had to put a lot of effort into it, because they really didn't take the Vietnamese that seriously. And you see the same thing in the Dutch Indies. The Dutch really don't take the Indonesians very seriously. They don't think that they're going to be able to put up much of a resistance. And even in the case of Korea, for instance, when there's the story of the first American troops that are sent to Korea just after the North Korean invasion, and one American general says, well, we'll just send these troops up to stop the North Koreans. Once the North Koreans see that the Americans are there and they mean business and they're not going to run, then that'll take care of the North Korean invasion right there. So there was this widespread tendency on the part of the Americans and all the European countries to just grossly underestimate what they were up against in trying to fight these Asian armed forces.
So how do, kind of looking forward then from this period in history, you know, how do these conflicts kind of set up the next several decades of Asian history? You know, I think there's been a lot of, you note at the end that eventually you have the Vietnam War, which is a very, which is itself another kind of very bloody conflict involving the U.S. On the other hand, you have historians who look at this and go, apart from the Vietnam War, Asia has a lot of interstate peace. There's not a lot of interstate war in Asia. On the other hand, you have a lot of historians who look at this history and look at this region and go, but there's a lot of intrastate conflict, where governments, whether communist, not communist, did a lot of violence against their own people. Anyway, I mean, that's obviously a lot of debate about how peaceful Asia was in the 20th, 21st century. But kind of how do these, in your view, how do these conflicts, Vietnam, Indonesia, Korea, China, how do they kind of set up the following decades of conflict, peace, whatever you wanted to characterize it in Asia?
Well, because the settlements of these conflicts between 1950 and 54, you might say the settlement of the first round of these conflicts didn't really settle anything. Korea and Vietnam end up as divided countries, so that the governments on both sides of the divide want to right this wrong as they see it. That is, they feel that their country should be united, but it only should be reunited under their rule. And you have the same thing with China, even though, of course, the communists by 1950 have completely gotten control of all of China on the mainland. There's still the island of Taiwan. And it turns out that because of the outbreak of the Korean War, Taiwan is able to maintain its independence for much longer than anybody expected. So that you have this flashpoint in China, as well as the flashpoints in Korea and Vietnam. And in the case of Indonesia, Indonesia, as you pointed out, doesn't become involved in any interstate conflicts, but there's conflict within Indonesia. A lot of the leaders of some of the outer islands, places that are not Java, revolt against the authority of the Indonesian Republic, and there are some little parts of the Portuguese and Dutch empires that are left over, don't become a part of Indonesia right away. So there's lots of occasions for conflicts there. And the other place, of course, that's rife with intrastate conflicts is Burma, which never really, I don't think you can ever pinpoint a time when Burma is completely free of some kind of intrastate conflict.
You know, to ask a similar question, but on a different country, which is namely the United States. You know, this is kind of the first time the U.S. has really had to play play a role as a superpower, play a role as a country that can influence the development of the international order of countries, and of course it's those impulses during the Cold War and afters lead the U.S. to some you can say pretty bad decisions. you look at Vietnam, you look at even recently Afghanistan and Iraq, and a lot of the mistakes that happened in those two conflicts. You know, with the looking at this decade after the Second World War and the U.S.'s role in it, kind of how do you see that I guess, sparking how the U.S. then acts kind of throughout the rest of the 20th century and 21st century, and it's as it tries to decide what kind of superpower it is.
Well, of course, throughout the Cold War, the U.S. is reacting to what it sees as aggressive communism, spearheaded by the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China. And that's the preoccupation of the U.S. Well into the to the end of the 1960s. And after that, of course, there are some experiments with detente and with sort of building an international order where the two sides can coexist. The U.S. finally recognizes the PRC at the end of the 70s, and the U.S. and Russia signed the Helsinki Accords, so that you might say the Cold War is stabilized, and then of course the Soviet Union soon after that collapses, and that leads to an entirely different situation. But almost everything in American foreign policy seems to be explainable with reference, in some way, with reference to the Cold War.
So I think that's a great place to end our conversation with Ronald Spector, author of A Constant Erupts: Decolonization, Civil War, and Massacre in Postwar Asia, 1945 to 1955. Obviously, the book covers such a long period of history, and there's so much interesting historical details in your book about all these conflicts. I did want to ask you kind of one last question, going beyond the book, which are, where can people find your work, and what do you think the next project might be?
Well, my book is for American readers, and I think a lot of people probably in Asia and Europe as well. You can get it from Amazon. And hopefully it's on sale in some of the larger bookstores like Barnes & Noble. So that's probably the easiest way. Well, the easiest way is just to go online and order it either from Amazon or from Barnes & Noble. But hopefully it's still... and new enough that it's in some of the bookstores. I'm sorry, what was the second half of your question?
Just what the next project might be?
Oh, I don't know. I'm negotiating with my agent and my publisher, but I'm thinking about writing something about the GI, American GIs and their experience in the China-Burma-India theater. And as a very interesting subject, aspect of World War II that I don't think has been covered very much. And that's really the first occasion in which you have thousands and thousands of Americans, most of whom never traveled more than 100 miles from their hometown. All of a sudden, they're transported halfway across the world. It takes at least 70 days to get to India, which is the sort of entry point for the China theater. And they're encountering, excuse me, peoples and societies that they never heard of before, except in maybe a geography book. And so the impact on both sides is very interesting. And of course, on top of all this, they have to fight a war against the Japanese, along with these strange peoples, the Chinese, the Indians, the Burmese, and they all have to win this very difficult war against Japan.
So, You can follow me, Nicholas Gordon, on Twitter at NickRIGordon. That's NickRIGordon. You can go to AsianReviewOfBooks.com to find other reviews, essays, interviews, and excerpts. Follow on Twitter at BookReviewsAsia. That's reviews plural. And you can find many more author interviews at the New Books Network at NewBooksNetwork.com. We hope you're listening to the Asian Review of Books podcast, now on all your favorite podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Rate us, recommend us, share us with your friends to support us interviewing those writing in, around, and about Asia. Stay tuned for who more info is coming up next on the show. But before then, Ronald, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.